Hi, this is The Takeaway for Monday, September 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us. And we have a lot to get to on this Monday. The White House released a new version of the president's travel ban. We'll have more later this hour. Meanwhile, President Trump used most of his public comments over the weekend to criticize athletes who protest during the national anthem. We'll get to those protests in just a few minutes. President Trump did not give much public attention over the weekend to the crisis in Puerto Rico, but that's where we start today. Americans in Puerto Rico are slogging through the destruction left by two hurricanes. The island is largely without cell phone service and almost entirely without power. Residents there call the nighttime Boca de Lobo, or a wolf's mouth, because of the pitch-black darkness. And authorities are nervously watching the failed dam along the Guajataca River. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico's governor is pleading for more aid from FEMA and from the military, and the island's delegate to Congress said the storm had set Puerto Rico back 20 to 30 years. Let's get updates from two reporters now. Samantha Schmidt is with the Washington Post on the ground in San Juan.
It's pitch black, and it's actually pretty scary driving through the streets. I've only been in the San Juan area at night and tried to avoid it at all costs. And there's a curfew, so, you know, if you're not essential services or officials or, you know, emergency responders or the press, you cannot be out. You will be arrested because there's a lot of looting. It can get pretty scary out there, and, you know, streets aren't lit, so you don't really know where you're going. It's pretty bad.
A lot of looting you just mentioned. What is the security situation, particularly at night? Are there enough police?
Well, police are everywhere as far as I know, and I know that the governor actually made it so that justices can serve as peace officers. So I'm sure that he's added some other people to the force since then. So he's really boosting those law enforcement numbers. I must say, actually, all of the police officers I've spoken to, who have asked for directions from, have been very calm, very understanding and helpful.
And through all this, Samantha Schmidt, what are people doing for basic necessities? Are they able to go to the grocery store? Are they able to fill up on gas and do those basic things?
It's been a nightmare. I was in a town yesterday that was in the central mountainous area that's very particularly disconnected. And, you know, they had one supermarket that was open in town, and lines were crazy long. Food was rationed. They were only letting in 10 people at a time because they didn't want to have like stampedes. So people are telling me that it's not worth it because going to the grocery store would take all day. Going to the gas station, if there's a gas station, would take an entire day because the lines are so long. They were probably wrapping down half a mile down the highway in this town yesterday at the one gas station that was working. People are camping out at night, like sleeping in their cars. In one case, I heard about people that camped out in their cars and woke up the next morning to find out that gas in that station was out. It's miserable.
Samantha Schmidt, we appreciate you and all your reporting there amid the chaos in San Juan and across Puerto Rico. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Samantha Schmidt is with the Washington Post in San Juan. We turn now to Francis Robles, reporter covering the Caribbean and Central America for the New York Times. Francis is in San Juan as well.
The situation is so dire, mostly because there are so many people in so many different places who are suffering. And then just let's keep in mind that there's an island-wide power outage that also comes with no water. So that even if your house was not affected, how long can you live like that? So you're finding people all over the island in different places. The other day we went to Arecibo, I found people who had gotten doused with mud, but you can't even say flooded. You would say 7 feet of mud landed on their house and then it receded. They have no water. And so they were going to the mayor's office. They were going here. They were going there. And they didn't find it.
So as you go about town to town, Francis Robles, in terms of the aid or the relief that's coming through, are you just seeing people lined up and trying to get things back together themselves? Are you seeing authorities, government trucks, federal FEMA relief? What does it look like?
You know, I want to go to a few more towns because I'm wondering if I'm skewed by the few towns that I went where I did not see any like big operations of aid. I did see one government truck, a municipal water truck, where people were very calmly lined up receiving water in the southeast part of the island. That's the only one that I've seen. in Arecibo, where I mentioned the mud and the people had no water, I interviewed the emergency management director, and he said, oh yeah, well, we have one water truck, but I need 10. I did see a big kind of military looking operation, but I saw it at a hotel, you know, so it was obviously the U.S. government's kind of operation. And I don't know where they've actually been. And I need to figure that out, because what I'm seeing a lot of need.
Well, the governor has made those public pleadings, not only for FEMA, but for military flights. And very publicly, Francis Robles has compared the devastation of this storm directly to Katrina and Sandy, really trying to wake up Washington. From what you've seen, is it that bad?
The problem with comparing it to Katrina, I mean, didn't 1,000 people die in Katrina? I don't remember what the exact numbers were. And while I do think that the body count here is going to rise, because I think it's inevitable, it has been kind of shocking as to, so far anyway, the official number I think is 10. Where I think it's comparable, particularly to Sandy, is the way that it's all over the place, in the sense that you're seeing problems in so many different places, whether it's flooding, whether it's the roof having been blown off, the lack of water, just different kinds of problems in a lot of different places.
Francis Robles with the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, while Americans in Puerto Rico struggle to find gas and water and their governor pleads for aid, President Trump spent the public parts of his weekend mostly focused on criticizing NFL players and owners, and some NBA stars, too. An estimated 20% of all NFL players displayed some form of protest during the national anthem at their games on Sunday. Some teams, like the Pittsburgh Steelers, stayed off the field entirely during the anthem. It was all after the president used his Friday night rally in Alabama to say this. And we did choose to bleep the president's vulgar language here.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
It was just a little more than a year after Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem. Now this weekend's display of solidarity across pro sports was unprecedented. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's Monday now, Dave. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking first and foremost that it went above and beyond Sunday, what I thought. I mean, we're talking every single team saw some form of protest. The number of players who took a knee, somewhere between 150 and 200, and more players as well linking arms. When you talk to the players about why they were protesting, the common theme that you hear from Alex Smith, quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, who it's you have to say is white, or Lorenzo Alexander, linebacker for the Bills, you have to say is black, there is this unified line where they say, how can you have a president who refuses to criticize Nazis, but he criticizes professional football players? And I think that's where Donald Trump really stepped in it. I think Donald Trump was talking to his audience in Huntsville, Alabama, and his lizard brain, which is always attuned to the worst instincts of his audience, thought to himself, hey, I'm going to go after black football players who are concerned about racist policing and go after them for being unpatriotic. For my base, this is brilliant. And he did that. What he did not understand, maybe because he never played football himself, is that in the NFL, they have something they call a brotherhood. And it's almost an I Am Spartacus idea of if you attack one of us, you attack all of us. So even if the number of players who took a knee with Colin Kaepernick last year or were sitting with Michael Bennett this year was not great, what you saw instead was players saying, wait a minute, this is about something else than police violence right now. This is about the president calling for us to be fired if we exercise our First Amendment rights, calling for us to lose our jobs. And the president's comment, and I'm not going to say the words on your show, where he called these players SOBs, you have to understand, and I say this from having communicated with players, that connected and injured in a way that, again, Donald Trump, who is such a rank misogynist, could not understand. Because the role of the mother in the NFL locker room is kind of sacred. I mean, there's even an organization of NFL moms. They're active in the locker room. They talk to people. For example, Michael and Martellus Bennett's mother, and they're both protesting brothers in the NFL. Their mother, Penny Bennett, whom I've gotten to know, is a school teacher and still active in the public school system for over 20 years. Everybody on the team knows her. And Trump's offhand misogynism to these players was a slap in the face to Penny Bennett. And that was not something people could abide.
Dave, what spurred the owners to get involved here? These protest movements are not new. And for some reason, this time after the president made his remarks, owners, white owners of football teams felt the need to get publicly involved.
I mean, first and foremost, I think the answer is pretty elementary. It's the fact that Donald Trump didn't just attack the players in his speech in Alabama. He attacked the National Football League. He said the sport was terrible. He called on people to boycott the sport. And he poo-pooed the idea that players get traumatic brain injury and said that the league has just gotten soft. I mean, this runs against every corporate message of the National Football League. And it actually threatens the profits of the National Football League. And so owners had to make a choice. Like, are you going to stand up for this game in which you're so heavily invested? Or are you going to actually side with the president you supported, which seems like almost like an act of nihilism or self-immolation? So they were not going to do that. The second part, which also needs to be said, is we have to remember that even though every single owner in the National Football League is white, save for Shahid Khan of the Jacksonville Jaguars, 70% of the players are black. And so if owners sided with Donald Trump on this, you would have heard black players say, I guess black lives do not matter to the National Football League, and they would have been, I think, demonstrably correct.
Well, we saw one player in Major League Baseball, Bruce Maxwell, a catcher for the Oakland A's, take a knee during one game over the weekend. And these protests merged with the NBA because Golden State star Steph Curry, before the protest started, repeated his sentiment that he might not want to go to the White House to visit the president. These things started separately, but they're spreading across the leagues now, Dave.
They are, and not coincidentally, leagues that depend on black labor and black talent. In baseball, of course, you're just talking about one player, but basketball and football, I mean, they've just had enough with this president. And Donald Trump can say this isn't about race with one hand, and then in the other hand, he's going to tweet that NASCAR gets it right, which is a sport that said that they will fire players or drivers or pit crew people who protest during the anthem while they wave the Confederate flag. So, you know, Donald Trump has given the game away time and again. People who say this is not about race, I think, should look out for lightning clouds, striking them down if they dare repeat such a thing. And, you know, this is where we are. I'm not surprised to see it get generalized because, I mean, players have this high profile position, and Donald Trump is a racist and nature abhors a vacuum.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Protest is nothing new in sports. Muhammad Ali gave up his heavyweight title and nearly went to jail to protest injustice and the Vietnam War. The list goes on. John Carlos, Jim Brown, Bill Russell, there are others. In the last couple of years, a new generation of athletes using their platforms for protest have come online. Michael Bennett, LeBron James, the women of the WNBA, and quarterback Colin Kaepernick. We want to get another perspective now on national anthem protests, on the president's attacks on players and owners, and on the state of protest in pro sports. Tyler Tynes is a staff writer for SB Nation who covers the intersection of sports, race, and politics. Tyler, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, Tyler, I want to start with some of the coaches and some of the owners of the teams that we're talking about. Pete Carroll is the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. That's a team that stayed in the locker room during the national anthem in their game yesterday on Sunday. Pete Carroll said, "We can no longer stay silent. I stand with our players." How does that statement strike you, and what did you see yesterday?
I mean, it strikes me as the very one of the better statements of, you know, Pete not being silent, but he can do that kind of in his area of where he is, you know, Pacific Northwest, with a fan base that's a little more left-leaning out there for the Seahawks, and also a team that has become used to not only political statements, but their black players speaking up and speaking emphatically about what is right, racial justice, white supremacy, etc. So for that team, it's not uncommon to see something like this, but a lot of these coaches and a lot of the statements from coaches, owners, even higher-ups in these organizations are not, you know, They're not speaking about race. They're not being very front forward facing about race or a white supremacist president or anything that has to do really with the systemic injustices that these black people are protesting for, because the understanding has to be that this is not a response to Trump. Trump is, like he's done with so many other opportunities, he's inflamed the situation with his comments and his rhetoric. This is about police brutality. This is about systemic injustice. This is about white supremacy and the fans of white supremacy becoming not only more inflamed, but a re-rise of white supremacy, a redemptive type of moment in American history, as we're seeing with Donald Trump's presidency. So this has nothing to do with Trump as far as it comes to protests. This has to do with black athletes who are bearing the brunt and using and taking the onus of America's conscience, as they always have done, to talk about American societal ilk and how bad it has become for folks of color.
And yet there is a danger that with the protests becoming so visible and so much more widespread than they were a year ago, that this is about Trump in a way. I mean, lots and lots of players have watched Michael Bennett, have watched Colin Kaepernick protesting, a couple of other players too. But it's only this weekend, after the president's remarks insulting players or calling them SOBs, that you saw this massive show of solidarity.
Again, you know, I think we shouldn't, and not necessarily to be too hard on black athletes, because again, when it comes to speaking about these issues, especially in the realms of entertainment or athletics, it always comes down to black athletes who have to shoulder this brunt, right? Like, it's up to them to say, okay, we're going to be the conscience. We're going to do right. We're going to tell America how it's messed up so badly because it's affecting us. And we see so many white players and white athletes who are doing the exact same thing they've done for generations. But the difference is that we disproportionately are asking black players to do more. I mean, black players are of the bottom rungs here of poverty and have to break the chains of cyclical poverty. They get out of that and become the 1% to get into the NFL. And the NFL is only going to keep you for about 2 to 3 years on average. So if black players want to protect their money and want to protect their families and want to do things like that, that's fine. I'm not asking you to step out into these protest streets. The difference is when you do, right? So we've seen a flashpoint at this moment of Donald Trump saying what he said, and that has changed how a lot of players feel, because if they ever felt there was a safer moment to do it, it was right now, not when Kaepernick was doing it. They should receive blame for not standing up, but I also understand why they didn't. I'm more concerned with white athletes who are in that same safe zone of where they could have spoken up this weekend and chose not to. I have more concern with Derek Carr and Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady and white quarterbacks and players and owners and coaches who thought that these unifying arm links were more important than speaking very viciously and very emphatically about systemic injustice.
Well, Tyler Tynes, the president has again reacted to the controversy that he helped create here. Let's hear from President Trump on the tarmac talking to reporters.
I've never said anything about race. This has nothing to do with race or anything else. This has to do with respect for our country and respect for our flag.
Tyler Tynes, the president says this has nothing to do with race. I never said anything about race.
I mean, well, he's a liar. This has everything to do with race. This is every single thing to do with race. He chose to specifically target black athletes. Whether that's conscious or unconscious, it does not matter. He chose and targeted black athletes, some of the biggest names in two of the biggest sports that we have in this country. So this is 100% about race and two leagues that are only embracing blackness and are also in black cities and have black employees, except at the highest levels of their charts. Like this is 100% about race. And when you say that these people should be fired, when you use profane language to describe them, you're not talking about white players. When you're talking about this has to be respect for our flag and our country, well, only one side of the racial chart thinks that there's no respect for the country. There's white fans and conservative fans who think that black people are just non-patriotic, when black people have to not only care about themselves and their families and care about not being shot down in the streets and all of the injustices and oppression that they have to go through just being black in America, there are some of the most patriotic people you could also find. How hard does it have to be to care about your own humanity and then uplift a country that is spit in your face time after time after time? Again, no, they are patriotic just like you're patriotic. This has nothing to do with the country, nothing to do with the flag, because this is about police brutality, state-sanctioned violence, systemic oppression, and white supremacy being posited by a president who's uplifting that same notion. No, this has all to do with race.
Tyler Tynes, staff writer for SB Nation. Tyler, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We put out the call, and we've been hearing from you on this story.
Taking a knee is not a sign of disrespect. If anything, it is a proof of what the American flag stands for, in that people have a right to reasonably express their dissent.
your voice on NFL protests, and many of you are speaking out on our Facebook page. Nemesio writes, I serve my country, and as a Vietnam vet, I feel that the First Amendment isn't just to protect the radical white supremacists who spew venom and hatred, but it also protects anyone who has grievances against unfair and brutal treatment of our citizens. Jeff wrote, what could be more American than standing to respect the symbol that brave men and women who have died for your freedoms? And Aaron wrote, if we can't protest for equality, then we aren't the country we say we are. We want your voice. Tell us what you think. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always head to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. By Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The White House announced a new travel ban on Sunday. This time, not all of the countries affected are Muslim majority, although most are. And this time, the ban is permanent, no longer with a 90-day time limit. Five countries from the current travel ban, the former travel ban, remain affected. That's Iran, Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Somalia. And the new ban now adds three other countries, Chad, North Korea, and Venezuela. Although in Venezuela's case, the targets are primarily government officials, and it's far less stringent than the other countries in the ban. Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department. He joins us now. Leon, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thank you.
Give us your outline as an immigration expert here on this new ban and what exactly it does.
Well, the purpose of the new ban is to remedy the infirmities of the first two bans in order to show that there was a rigorous process conducted and to show that the reason for the ban is purely security-based and not based on any other extrinsic factors that may be objectionable. So what the administration does is they say they did a three-pronged analysis, and the three-pronged analysis had to do with, one, a country's ability to identify its citizens, meaning does a specific country actually know that Joe Smith is Joe Smith as opposed to somebody else, a particular country's ability to actually be a safe national security country in general, meaning that it's not a country that imports and exports terrorism, and three, a country's ability to actually not just have identity information, but also information that's criminal records, terrorist watch lists, etc. And then based on that, it had come up with a list of about 47 countries that were inadequate or at risk. And then it got down to 16 countries, and then it negotiated with those 16 countries to end up with the eight countries that are now on the list that you've just identified previously.
So what did the Trump administration see coming down the pike from the courts or elsewhere that led to this revised version that they think will pass judicial muster? And do you think it will pass that muster?
I think what it saw from the courts was that there was too much of a link with the original sin of the campaign promise of the Muslim ban that the first two orders had that they needed to extricate themselves from. And so they needed to conduct the kind of serious analysis that they say they've conducted. I mean, I have no reason not to think it was serious given all of the information that was released by the administration last night. And so the question is, in terms of will the court say that it will pass muster, the court has to make two separate decisions. One, the court needs to decide whether it's going to moot out the current case, which is to say, is it not going to pass judgment on what happened in the past? And I think that's pretty likely that the court isn't going to want to do that, given that such high stakes shouldn't, you know, be judged based on a policy that no longer exists anymore. And then the question is, moving forward, is the court going to require a brand new lawsuit to be filed just on this? Or is the court actually going to pass muster on what's been done now? If the court actually decides to move forward and adjudicate what's been done now, I think that most likely, given the ideological composition of the court and given how important these security risks are, given how many recent terrorist attacks we've seen, that the court probably will allow this current order to move forward, even though it is true that its genesis was an original Muslim ban.
A new version of the White House's travel ban from President Trump. This one still affecting Iran, Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Somalia, but some other countries too, as the White House struggles to overcome judicial objections. Leon Fresco, immigration attorney, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Special forces in the U.S. military date back to World War II. They played a big role in Vietnam as well. But it was in the late 1970s that special forces began their modern use that we see today. This week's Retro Report looks at how the hijacking of an Air France plane from Tel Aviv to Entebbe, Uganda, helped to spawn modern commando tactics. Kit Roan is a producer with Retro Report, and he says the daring operation by Israeli special forces to rescue hostages caught the notice of Americans who would soon come to use special forces in some important successes and in some failures, too.
Entebbe was different because the terrorists took the plane full of the hostages to an airport that was about 2,200 miles away from Israel. It's something that's very, very hard to get to, and no one thought that a rescue there would be possible.
So, you know, I asked my father what's going to happen. He told me, you know, we're probably dead meat because Israel never negotiated. He even made the argument it's way too far for Israel to intervene.
The Israelis proved that to be wrong. They went and they rescued the hostages. There were, you know, in the end, only four hostages were killed in the raid, and one commando lost his life. But it was seen as a wake-up call to other Western powers that you really could project this kind of force deep into what was kind of seen as enemy territory and stop these hijackings.
We're talking about real countries like the U.S., of course, U.K., Germany, Italian, all came to learn. It was like the whole world said, wow, they have chutzpah, these guys. They are damn good. Entebbe gave a green light to governments that there is maybe another way, and not just to surrender.
And then the attempted commando raid to rescue hostages held in Tehran during the Islamic Revolution. This is Operation Eagle Claw, and people might remember that it was a spectacular failure.
Left behind in the desert of Iran are the bodies of eight American servicemen, seven U.S. aircraft, and many questions.
So in the aftermath of this very public and very tragic failure, helicopters in the desert, U.S. servicemen dead in the desert in Iran, what happened with the culture of special operations and the use of it in the military in the United States?
Eagle Claw really sort of focused the administration and the U.S. government on the idea that, look, for us to be able to do this on a routine basis, you have to have everyone who's involved in these operations has to be special. They have to be coordinated from the pilots to the ground forces to the support forces. They all have to have worked together, gone through these situations, and it needs to be treated as almost like a separate branch of the military and be well-funded. So what became sort of small units that did these things occasionally became sort of a standing force that could be called on routinely to handle these types of situations and to do them effectively.
And now in the age of terror, with asymmetrical threats and asymmetrical combat, special forces are 70,000 strong. It's really a gigantic force. And the most successful raid of the modern era, the raid on Abbottabad, SEAL Team 6.
The United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
The entire operation, from the time the SEALs landed in the compound to when they finally took off with bin Laden's body, took only 38 minutes.
Was there a moral hazard involved in the success of this raid? Did Americans take away a message from Abbottabad that maybe isn't the best message?
It's a lot easier to do a raid like this and say, look, this shows we're doing something. When in actuality, you know, you may not be. You may just be treading water. To really change the landscape in one of these places, you need strategy, and you can't just sort of do this whack-a-mole, going after leader and expect to solve the problem. There's a tendency not to call these things insurgencies. There's a tendency to look at them as these sort of, ISIS or these terrorist groups that can be conquered. But in many ways, these are insurgencies. Insurgencies take time, and they take, and there's diplomacy that needs to be put to work, and economic aid, and all sorts of things that go far beyond one-off operations against the military leaders.
Can America win the war on terror by kicking down doors at night and taking people out?
Have we won so far?
Kit Rohn is producer at Retro Report. Thanks for being here, Kit.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org by Constant Contact, offering tools including an editor and drag-and-drop action blocks for helping small businesses communicate with their customers across the country using email marketing. Learn how at constantcontact.com. And Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at moo.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And one thing that may have flown under your radar as this week begins, today begins Banned Books Week. This week was started by the Banned Books Coalition in 1982 as an annual celebration of the freedom to read. Now, the American Library Association has released its annual list of the most challenged books. And at the top of the list in 2016 was This One Summer. It's a coming-of-age story about two preteen kids. But the book was more than challenged. This graphic novel was banned by school districts in Minnesota and Florida, even after being highly honored in children's literature.
I think once it won those awards, people automatically thought picture book or appropriate for children, when in reality, the Caldecott honor is awarded to books for kids up to 14.
That's Jillian Tamaki, one of the co-authors of This One Summer. The book's critical acclaim may have led it into the hands of some unprepared younger readers, but it also came under scrutiny for exploring the struggles that kids endure when they deal with drugs or sex, or if they're asked to grow up before they're ready. Mariko Tamaki and Jillian Tamaki are cousins. They're the co-creators of This One Summer. So today, to mark the 35th annual Banned Books Week in America, we invited them on to talk about why having your book challenged and banned on such a wide scale isn't quite as exciting as you might think.
It's the weird juxtaposition where you will say, you know, this is the most banned book of last year, and people will automatically say congratulations or they'll cheer. I get that. But in reality, it is quite depressing when you think about it. And the reality is, under most challenges, the ALA is not notified. They are just taken off the shelf. I read a thing where for every one challenge that's reported, there are 3, 4, 5 instances where the book is just pulled.
The other side of this is that there are lots of cases in libraries where a librarian could go and see that a book has been placed in, say, the elementary school section or like a young reader section and just move it to the teen section. So there's lots of cases where it's just a matter of moving the book and librarians just manage that. Also, it's worth noting that every time that there's a challenge, so every time someone comes up to a librarian and says, I don't think this book should be on the shelves, librarian can give them a form that says, okay, you fill out a specific form. That doesn't necessarily mean the book is removed. And a lot of the times, librarians can sort of sit down and say, well, let's do some more research about this book, and does this complaint merit removing the book? It doesn't always get removed.
Well, what was in your book that parents found so objectionable?
It's profanity, drug use, which I assume is smoking, and then LGBTQ characters. And this is the interesting one to me, is sexually explicit themes, which I don't even know where that comes from. Sex exists in the book, but it's certainly not explicit.
Right. The point of the book was to look at the experience of a younger person. I mean, it's not to put a younger person in an inappropriate, like, older person thing. Like, it's always hilarious to me, like, The Hunger Games is a book about a teenage girl or a bunch of teenagers who are forced into an arena to kill each other until only one is left. So that somehow isn't, like, an inappropriate for young person experience. But two young girls sitting on a couch and trying to figure out what oral sex is, and they don't know. Like, it doesn't explicitly describe the thing because the two kids don't know. I tried to keep it, you know, whatever they're talking about is still appropriate for the kid's age. It's just that they're talking about adult things, but in a very kid way.
It seems to me that what you're describing is something that happens to kids all the time. It's part of growing up. hearing adults or older kids talking about things that you don't understand that might make you uncomfortable, or that you know adults do but aren't for you, and trying to process what that means.
I mean, the book is completely about that liminal space, and they're overhearing teenagers talk about sex, and it's supposed to be scary because that stuff is scary to you when you're a younger kid, and it's supposed to be capturing that sense of fear a little bit, or unknown.
There are situations in your book as well where kids are renting R-rated slasher films, you know, having nightmares about going into sort of that older teen space and not really liking what they see.
Yeah, which I always thought, I mean, to me, there was like that point in life where slumber parties went from watching The Secret of NIMH, and I felt too quickly, you know, descended into Nightmare on Elm Street.
It's like a very messy, clunky, scary transition. One does not go from being a quote-unquote complete innocent to a fully mature, rounded, balanced person, adult.
Let's be fair to some of these parents. If your book was in elementary schools when it should have been in middle schools, or 9-year-olds were accessing it when they should have been 14-year-olds, do you have some sympathy? Do you think your book was necessarily appropriate for every kid that picked it up?
I mean, like, there's two things. One is the book is in the wrong place and it should be moved to a place for the appropriate readers. And the other is just the sort of blanket notion that a book is inappropriate because it contains things that make a person uncomfortable. And that's the thing that was frustrating, especially like when you think of a book being removed, some of the libraries we're talking about are high school libraries. So the perfect place for a kid to read something that they find uncomfortable or that they find challenging is a high school, because they're surrounded by people who are there to talk to you about the things that you don't understand. And the idea that instead what you do is remove a book so that you just avoid the conversation altogether is really frustrating.
As we're talking about challenges and banning, I think it's important to make that distinction. A challenge is an opening of a conversation. Most of the time, that conversation is opened and you discuss the merits, and most times it does stay on the shelf. Maybe it gets recategorized. That can be seen as a very healthy process as opposed to banning, which is removal.
Well, Mariko, Jillian, this one summer was banned in some schools and some high schools, and it makes me want to turn around and ask you, would you read part of it on our air, please?
Sure. This is from This One Summer. I know a little about sex. When I was in second grade, my teacher, Mrs. Sloan, got pregnant, so we had a class about where babies come from. My dad said there should be a class where they put us in a cage until we're 20. Last year in health, we took this quiz, and we had to show it to our parents so they could see what we knew about sex. My dad thought it was funny I spelled penis wrong. I wonder if they teach sex education here. I wonder if that guy Dunk knows. I'm sure he does.
The book is This One Summer. There are a few high schools and libraries around America where you will not find that book because it was censored and banned, but you will hear it here on The Takeaway, and you'll also hear the authors, Mariko and Jillian Tamaki. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Conservative provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos was set to hold a free speech week at the University of California, Berkeley this week. The idea here was to protest what Yiannopoulos sees as a stifling of speech and conservative ideas on liberal college campuses. But after a month of controversy and planning, the small student group called the Berkeley Patriot that had organized the event instead canceled it. Yiannopoulos briefly visited the campus anyway. He stood in front of a crowd of about 100 supporters and protesters, while more people protested from behind police barriers. But UC Berkeley has a long history of campus activism, and Milo chose it because it's an epicenter for the debate on free speech and political correctness on college campuses. Takeaway producer Isabel Angel brings us a personal history of free speech at Berkeley.
All this political tension at UC Berkeley would have been unthinkable, not because the school was considered a bastion of liberal thinking, but because it was against campus rules.
See, they weren't allowed to have political speeches on campus unless both sides were there at the same time.
That's my grandfather, Ray Kolvig. In the 1960s, he was the public information officer at Berkeley. When he was there in 1963, students started pushing against the university's policy.
And the students, a far-left group at Berkeley, wanted to bring Malcolm X to speak on campus. And the vice chancellor said, no, we can't do that. We can't allow that.
Malcolm X ended up speaking at the YMCA. but students were getting more politically involved, and the administration firmly believed that education and politics did not mix. So instead of welcoming the activism, the university doubled down. In the fall of 1964, the dean of students sent a letter to all the organizations saying they couldn't set up tables at the entrance to the campus for political causes.
And, of course, this raised the ruckus right away.
And then, about 1 month later...
there was kind of a little protest going on. This guy got up on a chair and started to talk. He sounds interesting. I said, who's that guy? And one of my friends says, well, his name is Savio.
Mario Savio was a 21-year-old philosophy student who had spent the summer in the South with the civil rights movement. Back at Cal in the fall of 64, he wanted to raise money for the civil rights group SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and get other students to join the cause. That's when he came up against the university's strict policy against outside politics on campus.
My life changed from that moment on.
The day after my grandpa saw Savio speak on the chair, October 1st, 1964, activist Jack Weinberg sat down at his table, now illegal under university rules, and waited. The police came and arrested him and put him in the police car.
If you were a student and identified yourself, you would be disciplined by the dean's office. You're not identifying yourself, we're arresting you because you must be an outsider.
But students surrounded the car, and one man got on top to address the crowd.
And the police were, we only had a small police group at that time. They didn't wear military-looking things. They wore loafers, sort of, things. And so they came out, and they tried to move him off, but he said, no, we're going to stay here. And then the others started coming up.
I'm going to get off the car, okay.
And pretty soon Savio was up. He took his shoes off first so he wouldn't scratch the car. And he began to talk.
We're staying right here until this guy is released.
And he was fascinating.
We must really feel very, very sorry for these poor policemen here, you know.
He had ways of expressing language that was different from others. And it was a real phenomenon.
Very like, you know, Adolf Eichmann. He had a job to do. He fit into the machinery.
And it was exciting for me, of course. Could be scary at times.
Jack Weinberg was in the police car for 32 hours, and my grandpa was there all night talking to reporters. Administrators, led by the president of the UC system, Clark Kerr, got together behind closed doors to hammer out an agreement that would get the students to leave.
I propose that everybody at this meeting get into that damn building, then you sit at the desk, you sit on the floor, you make it absolutely impossible for them to conduct their work. Yeah!
In the end, Kerr did hand over an agreement, and Savio read it to the crowd. Jack Weinberg would be released. The school would set up a committee of students and administrators to review the policy toward political activities on campus, and students would stop all illegal protest activity.
All right. I would like that those who have taken part in this protest will agree by acclamation to accepting this document.
But it was far from over. That night, the students gave themselves a name. The free speech movement. 2 months later, the university still hadn't made any changes to its policy, and the students were fed up. On December 2nd, 1964, Mario Savio climbed the steps of Sproul Hall, the main administrative building on campus, and he faced the crowd.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Students and activists occupied Sproul Hall for 2 days.
We shall overcome.
Even Joan Baez showed up.
We shall.
At 3 a.m. on December 3rd, police arrested around 800 people and took them to jail.
They're tugging them by their feet and throwing them down the stairs. They've thrown boys and girls down the stairs. their heads jostling and banging against the banisters and marble stairs.
The next day, students held a massive protest and shut down the campus with picket lines. UC President Clark Kerr had had enough. On December 7th, Kerr promised an extraordinary convocation at the Greek Theater on campus. Around 16,000 students filed in to listen to Kerr talk as the tension mounted.
The academic world and the people of this state expect of us conduct commensurate with our past achievements and our high capacities. We should expect no less of ourselves. Thank you.
Mario Savio was there, but as my grandpa Ray Colvig recalled, the administration didn't want to let him speak.
And the people were worried about Savio. They were worried that he would lead the students out of the bottom of the Greek theater up onto the stage, and you'd have a real riot going on there. So there was a lot of police there.
Then Savio took the stage.
So Savio strode over to the microphone, and he started to speak, and the police came and grabbed him. They pulled him along by his necktie.
My grandpa told me that moment was a turning point in the free speech movement.
And the fact that this happened at the end of Kerr's speech, in front of everybody, that really led to the faculty having their huge meeting in Wheeler and voting, very big majority, voting to give in to what was generally the city center law, you know, that you could speak in public places, and the campus was not different from that.
My grandpa died in 2012, just 4 months after we had this conversation. So he's not around to see all the controversy playing out today. And even though the student leaders called off their far-right free speech week at Berkeley, my uncle, Tim Colvig, says my grandpa would have agreed with the university's decision to allow them to speak.
I think it would have been painful for him to have the university protecting that sort of speech. But I do believe that he would have believed that they ought to be able to speak, as painful as that is.
For The Takeaway, I'm Isabel Angel.
A history of speech and free speech at Berkeley. Call us with your thoughts about protests on the NFL sidelines, banned books, or anything else you're watching or hearing on the show. We're at 8778MyTake or on Twitter, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.